Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When Linda and Charlotte Mulhall murdered their mother's boyfriend, Farah Swali Noor, they set in motion a chain of events that was to horrify the country and destroy their already dysfunctional family. Described as the most grotesque of killings that was occurred within my professional lifetime by the judge who would eventually sentence the sisters in a Dublin courtroom, it was made even more infamous by the nickname given to the sisters by the tabloids. Linda and Charlotte Mulhall were dubbed the Scissor Sisters, since they did not just kill a man, but they dismembered his body and dumped it in the canal in pieces back in 2005. One of Dublin's most infamous cases, this week we'll be looking at what exactly happened according to the Mulhalls on that bank holiday weekend of March 2005, and just how do two sisters end up killing their mother's partner. Hello everybody and welcome back to Red Room, brought to you by Acast. This week we'll be looking at a case from the city I've lived in all my life and one that I know many of you also live in, Dublin, Ireland. Ireland in general is known as a pretty safe country, and usually as Irish people we tend to look outwards when it comes to true crime. A lot of us think that the worst of the worst only happens far abroad in the UK or in America. This presumption is absolutely untrue. Ireland is just like anywhere else. And although we have a small population, we are not without our faults or our murderers. And this week's case is brutal. Fair warning though, this is a graphic case, and although I tend to try and avoid unneeded gore, I will do so in this case, but it's technically impossible to really discuss the details of the Scissor Sisters case without explaining some of the gory details. And the detail can get nasty. So if you're listening with kids, maybe save it for later. But let's get into it. The Mulhalls were a Dublin family from Kilcare Gardens, a working class area in Talla on the south side of the city. It consisted of John Mulhall, who was married to Kathleen Mulhall, and the pair of them would go on to have 6 children, 3 boys and 3 girls. Kathleen's life was filled with abuse. She grew up as a member of a settled traveller family at the Macroom Road in Coolock, and in a later court hearing it was revealed that she was abused by her mother and her father. She was then wed at a, quote, very, very young age, but marriage was no respite for Kathleen, who would go on to marry John Mulhall from Talla in the 70s and mother 6 of his children. John Mulhall was known to be a heavy drinker, as was Kathleen, and most of their relationship was explosive and severely unhealthy. It caused a very unstable and at times violent environment for the entire Mulhall family. John was said to be extremely abusive towards Kathleen. And her lawyer would go on to argue that the violence by John was supported by Kathleen Mulhall's medical records. Their marriage would eventually break down, and soon after, Kathleen started dating a man who is at the centre of this story, a man called Faris Wali Noor, and they met in 2002. The two daughters that we know now as the Scissor Sisters were Kathleen's daughters, Linda and Charlotte. Linda Mulhall was 30 years old in 2005, the year of our crime. Growing up, Linda did not like school, and she dropped out before finishing her education. At the time of the murder, she was unemployed and she was a mother to four children. Her relationship with the father of her children had broke down, and her new boyfriend, a man called Wayne Kinsella, was extremely physically abusive to both her and her children. Wayne had a very sinister criminal record, including a conviction for attempted manslaughter, and at home, he was no different. The abuse had gotten so bad that he was convicted and sentenced to 7 years for beating Linda's children. During her time with Wayne, Linda lost a pregnancy, and after Wayne's conviction, her children would be taken from her into care by the social services. Linda, like both of her parents, had a history of alcohol and substance abuse. If she wasn't drinking, she was using heroin to numb her pain. However, previous to the crime, she had no convictions that involved violence or aggression of any kind. Linda's younger sister, Charlotte, was 23 years old in 2005. And just like her sister, she had a history of drug and alcohol abuse. She hadn't had any children yet. And around this time, she was working as a sex worker in Dublin, which she would actually later get some charges for. And that brings us to the victim of this crime. Faris Wali Noor arrived in Ireland in December 1996, and upon arrival to Ireland, he would claim that he was from Somalia and that his family had been killed during the Somali Civil War. But after an investigation, it was revealed that he was lying. He was actually from Kenya, and his family, including his wife, were back there alive and well. Now, I cannot express to you just how dark and sick this guy was, and it's why this case is so layered and nuanced and complicated. And although there is definitely no such thing as the perfect victim, Farah was, to put it lightly, a pretty sick individual. He had four previous convictions for things ranging from abusive behaviour and assault, but that is not where it ends. And I'm going to put in a content warning here for sexual assault. Farah was accused of raping three women in total, including the rape of a 16-year-old with learning disabilities in 1997. All three women gave birth to children as a result by the assault at the hands of Faris Noor. According to the Irish Independent, quote, in April 1998, he met and seduced another 16-year-old girl from Talla. She too was soon pregnant. She moved in with him after their son's birth. She said that at first he behaved, but later began drinking and taking drugs and regularly beat and abused her. When drunk, he often burned himself on the arms and the forehead with lit cigarettes. He always carried knives. Unsurprisingly, he was known to have a violent history with women, and Kathleen was no exception to this behaviour. Their relationship was described as fraught with violence, leading to Kathleen being hospitalised on numerous occasions due to the beatings she received at Farah's hands. The couple left Dublin when they first met and lived in Cork for a time, but eventually they would return to Dublin in 2004, which brings us right up to the year of the murder in 2005. St. Patrick's Day in Ireland is for two things: tourists and drinking. Although as an Irish person, I hate mentioning the stereotype that we're all just Guinness guzzling fiends who get so drunk we either fight or pass out. But it's unfortunately a central part to this week's story. St. Patrick's Day is a national holiday, and this year, 2005, it fell on a Thursday, with the celebrations spilling well into the weekend across the city. By March 20th, Kathleen Mulhall had been drinking heavily with her daughters Linda and Charlotte for days now, accompanied by her boyfriend Farah. Kathleen, Farah, Charlotte and Linda had been drinking a bottle of vodka on the Dublin boardwalk, Now, the days of drinking must have been taking a toll on them, as at one point Charlotte and Linda decided to take some ecstasy that they'd been stashing for a bit of a lift up. Arguments were going on during the weekend. One that is noted quite a lot in this case is when Farah apparently believed to have seen one of his children on the street, who he approached. This caused quite a bit of commotion and it annoyed Kathleen, who grew very angry with him. The party was soon moved to Kathleen's rented cottage, which was nearby in Summerhill, a short walk from the city centre. And it was here that things would go haywire. The group continued to drink, and Kathleen decided to crush up some ecstasy pills and spike Farah's drink so that they could all be on the same buzz, according to official testimony. Farah, as we said, was getting a little bit tetchy. He was known to be a very unlikable person when drunk. Allegedly, what kicked everything off was when Farah sat beside Linda on a couch and began touching her and speaking to her in a sexual and suggestive way. When Linda asked him to stop, he refused to let her go. He had been grabbing her by the waist. Charlotte, who Linda was actually sitting on her lap, became extremely agitated with Farah and watched as he leered on her sister. He then turned to them and whispered how they were both creatures of the night. This was when all three women in the cottage became hysterical. Kathleen allegedly tried to throw Farah out of her house, but he refused to leave. That was when Kathleen asked something of her daughters that would seal the fate of the rest of their lives. She shouted and begged for the girls to kill him, saying if they didn't do it, she would be dead by the end of the year. Obediently, as if they'd been thinking this all the time, they did it. Charlotte made the first move. She slashed Farah across the throat with a nearby Stanley knife. She hit an artery. Farah stood up and he stumbled. He tried to get into the bedroom, but he fell pretty quickly, slamming his head on a bed frame and falling unconscious. Then Linda joined in. She picked up a hammer, hitting him on the head repeatedly as he lay on the ground. Amid the bloodbath, they continued to stab Farah more than 20 times. After a short amount of time, the girls and Kathleen realised what they had done, that Farah was no longer responsive. They had a problem on their hands and they needed to solve it fast. The three women had to dispose of a body now, but presumably this was going to be too big to be dragged by them and them alone, never mind dumping it somewhere without anyone seeing them on what was possibly the busiest weekend in the city. The city was going to be jam-packed with people for the rest of the weekend, especially at night time for St. Patrick's Day Festival. Town was rammed. They weren't going to go unnoticed. Charlotte would later claim that it was her mother's idea to dismember Farah's corpse. She told Gardaí, "Me mammy just said cut him up. I just remember cutting. I cut him up with a knife." And so they did it. Linda and Charlotte Mulhall dragged Farah's lifeless body into the bathroom and took it in turns to decapitate and dismember him. They called her dad John for help, who always said he would do anything for his girls. He would come around, but when he saw what they had done, he refused to get involved and left them to it. Armed with just a bread knife and the weapons they had killed him with, Charlotte and Linda spent hours cutting up Farah's body in the bathroom, packing most of the parts into various plastic bags. Meanwhile, Kathleen organised a huge cleanup of her cottage. A forensic psychologist would later claim the sisters decapitated him to, quote, remove torment, and they cut off his penis as a signal of power. When the dismemberment was complete, the body parts were placed in black plastic bags and then in a sports bag before being dumped in the nearby canal. Linda would later recall to Irish police that Charlotte started sawing his legs with a knife. The smell wouldn't go away and that she thinks about it every single night. The next morning, the women decided to act quickly in disposing of his body parts, deciding also to dump the head separately from his remains in hopes of deterring any identification. To this day, the head and penis of Farah Nóir have never been found. Charlotte and Linda stuffed his remains in a sports bag and took multiple trips to the nearby Royal Canal where they dumped his limbs and his torso. Next, they would put Farah's severed head in a backpack. and they brought it on board a Dublin bus during rush hour to their hometown in Talla. The girls decided initially to hide it in a park that they knew pretty well in Talla. According to Linda, though, she had a feeling a few days later that she had to move it again. There'd been a lot of rain, and they buried it on a hill, and with the soil moving, it would have ended up exposed. And she did it. She would later tell police that she returned to where they buried the head, she dug it up, and moved it to another location, before bringing it in her son's school bag to another field close by in Talla. Then she either tried to set the bag on fire or dumped it in a bin. It depends on what story you believe. She's told multiple over the years, but she does say that she kissed the bag, telling Farah that she was sorry and said a prayer.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Linda would later claim it was Charlotte's idea to dismember the body. But Charlotte, who initially flat out denied her involvement in the murder, said her mother Kathleen was who instructed the sisters to kill Farah and gave them the knife and the hammer. She is also who, according to Charlotte, ordered them to cut up the body. It had been 10 days since the Mulhall women killed Farah on March 20th, 2005, and so far, nothing had turned up. But Linda would later say in statements to the Gardaí that she was tormented knowing what her and her sister had done. She said the smell of his body haunted her and stated on multiple times that if she could turn back time, she would. But this was all much later. As far as the Mulhalls were concerned, Farah's body was gone. Then, on the 30th of March 2005, something was spotted floating in the Royal Canal. A group of youngsters were gathering around, seemingly fascinated by what appeared. They thought they saw a leg or a foot floating in the water. The canal is known to wash up all sorts, and sometimes mannequins get dumped here. And sometimes all sorts of uproar can be caused before the true identity is revealed, often being pretty disappointing. Now, on this day, Chief Superintendent Christy Manigan got a call on his day off telling him that a body part had been found in the canal. At first, he presumed it would be another false flag. So he asked the police, were they sure what they found was a body part? And they confirmed that this was a dismembered piece of a body. A leg with a sock was visible, as well as a torso wearing an Ireland jersey. The Garda sub-aqua unit were sent in to retrieve 7 parts, immediately noting that the head was missing. This obviously caused massive issues in identifying the victim. The deputy state pathologist, Dr. Michael Curtis, would later call in and confirm that the body was that of a black adult male. The rest remained a mystery. Unsurprisingly, there was lots of media attention from the get-go, with initial speculation that this could be a voodoo killing. Now, this sounds kind of wild and speculatory at first, but there were examples of these killings happening at this time in the UK, where bodies were turning up decapitated and headless. The Garda and public became concerned that this could be the start of ritualistic killings in the city. The case ran cold for a while. They still had no ID, but once they had confirmed the race of the victim, they had a lead. They tried cross-checking the missing persons of Ireland. They didn't come up with much, so they sent out a media appeal. The police also had some pretty advanced and fascinating forensics run on his remains, including a water specialist from Belfast, who was able to confirm that the unnamed victim had spent at least 3 months of their life in the Ballybock area, which is pretty interesting. Then, after the media appeal, a person came forward saying that they had ran into Farrin Orr on March 20th, who was accompanied by his girlfriend and their daughters, but they hadn't seen him since. Garda then looked into Kathleen, and they noticed that she was registered at an address right around the corner from Croke Park, which is where their crime scene was. This is also around the area where the water specialist said the body had likely lived in. From asking around about Farah, the police also found out about his violent past, and they heard from others who knew him that he was always in trouble when drinking, which the police knew he was on the last day he was seen by the witness. The police did arrest and question the Mulhall women, who all denied having anything to do with the murder. And since the police didn't have any concrete evidence to charge them, they had to let them go. Now, they did search Kathleen's house, which they suspected was the scene of the crime. Blood traces were shown through luminol testing all over the home, but this still wasn't evidence that the Mulhalls committed the crime, just that it likely happened in the cottage. The police knew they needed a confession or a witness statement, but nobody seemed to hear anything unusual from that night. Now, they had been speaking to John Mulhall since the initial arrests, and the police could tell that he knew something. He was holding it back, though. He apparently was very disturbed over the fact that the head of Farah had never been recovered. He kept bringing it up. And at one point, he let it slip to Garda that Linda was the one who knew and who they needed to speak to in regards to Farrin Orr's head. So, on the way one day to Store Street Garda Station, Chief Superintendent Christy Manigan decided to drop into Linda to question her informally. He said she was apprehensive at first, but eventually invited them in for tea. The group spoke and eventually left to no avail. But after a while, Linda would call Christy Manigan directly. She was very upset. She said she wanted to talk. They knew they had their confession and they knew they had to act fast. Linda would go on to tell Garda everything she knew, from how they met up that day to party, to arguments that happened leading up to the murder, to the ecstasy and the alcohol they consumed. She told them about the argument in the apartment, the stabbing, and the frenzy that ended in Farah being killed and dismembered in Richmond cottages, about how they disposed of the body parts, the cleaning of the apartment, and how they would visit the dumping site a few days later to make sure the remains were still covered. She told them how the media frenzy drove her mad, and that she and her sister and her mother were keeping up with the story in the papers for weeks afterwards. She said that she had turned to alcohol and had self-harmed, which resulted in her spending over a week in a psychiatric hospital. The police had their confession. Now they had to make their arrests. Charlotte and Linda were arrested and charged with the murder in December 2005, with their mother Kathleen going on the run and escaping to England. Upon the news of their confession and the details that came out about the murder, their father, John Mulhall, would take his own life in December that year. Linda and Charlotte were both charged with the murder and they pled not guilty in the Central Criminal Court. Their trial took place in October 2006, with Linda Mulhall being found guilty of manslaughter, while Charlotte was found guilty of murder in the first degree. Linda's jury accepted her defence of provocation, and her confession and admission of feeling guilty about the murder likely helped in her sentencing. Charlotte Mulhall was given the mandatory life sentence, and Linda Mulhall was given a 15-year sentence, a sentence that Linda would appeal, but it would be upheld. Mr. Justice Paul Carney would remark on the case that this is the most grotesque case of killing that has occurred in my professional lifetime. The Irish media would dub the Mulhalls as the Scissor Sisters, something which made for tabloid gold, and I'm sure sold them lots of newspapers. The testimony that came from court was almost unbelievable. Three women brutally murdering and chopping up the body of a full-grown man. It's pretty extraordinary. The amputation of Farah's genitals was a big talking point too. Forensic psychologist Dr. Kira Staunton would later state in a documentary that the decapitation and the removal of the penis is very symbolic, something which could be deeply subconscious. The removal of the head is almost like the removal of the torment, the constant verbal abuse that's now been removed. Again, the penis as a sexual component for women who have been sexually victimized all their life, this is a signal of power. And this removal of the genitals of a victim, specifically the penis, by a female perpetrator, is seen in some cases where the victim has had a history of abuse especially. Kathleen Mulhall went on the run throughout her daughter's arrest and trial, which she voluntarily returned to Ireland in February 2008, and she was charged with two counts of giving false information to Gardaí about where Farah was and withholding valuable information from police and impending an arrest in a murder investigation. This was pretty controversial, as many believed she was an accessory to the murder, and the charges seemed pretty light for someone who was in the room when her daughters killed and decapitated her boyfriend and then went on the run when they were arrested for the crime. Kathleen pled guilty to helping clean up a crime scene and to conceal evidence, and she was sentenced to 5 years in prison in May 2009. So, where are the Mulhall women now? Well, Charlotte remains in prison. She caused a massive national controversy in 2008 when a photograph was leaked showing her holding a knife to the throat of a male prisoner in Mountjoy, which led to her being transferred to Limerick Prison, the only other prison to contain a women's unit in Ireland. In 2013, she wrote a 3-page letter that was obtained by the Sunday World. In it, she spoke about the murder and her relationship with her sister. She says she doesn't know where Farah's head is buried and only Linda can tell Gardaí where to find it. She said she regretted the murder, and it still gives her nightmares. She said she hated her sister Linda, who she says should have taken more blame for the butchering of Farah Nóir. She wrote, "I hate her so much. She should have got life, not me. She did more than what I did that horrific night. It went a bit out of control." She blamed her mother Kathleen on her abuse at the hands of Farah, and she said she believed Kathleen deserved all of the abuse she suffered throughout her life. Charlotte wrote, "She should have got life." When talking about her mother, she used to tell Farah all the time she was pregnant, but she wasn't really. She would then tell him that she miscarried and buried the baby at the back garden. Charlotte remains in prison, but is set for release some point this year. Linda was released from prison in 2018 after serving 13 years of her 15-year sentence. The Sunday World tracked her down to be now living in Kildare, but when they spoke to her, she claimed she wanted to be left alone and to move on with her life. Kathleen Mulhall was freed from jail in October 2011 and she immediately left and moved to London. Despite a rocky relationship with Charlotte, after the letter claiming her mother deserved to be abused, Charlotte is now the only one of her daughters that Kathleen speaks to. She would say in 2019, "I only talk to Charlotte. She is my life. She is my only child." She claims that she was hopeful to reunite with Linda after she was released, but that it all fell apart when Linda didn't contact her back in 2018. Kathleen also says she was dying of a serious lung condition, saying that she is waiting a huge operation on the lung and she might need to have half of it removed. She seems to have survived so far and has settled back on the north side of Dublin, apparently just around the corner from the Richmond cottages. The Scissor Sisters murder has got to be one of the most sensational murder stories in Irish history. But apart from the graphic nature of the crimes, I think it can really shine a light on the effect of cycles of abuse, poverty and familial trauma. It's impossible to know whether the Mulhalls would have had a better chance at life if they had a more stable upbringing. Or even Farah Nóir for that matter. It's impossible to know would they have all ended up in that situation that they did on that bank holiday in 2005. Chief Superintendent Christy Manigan would ponder this while talking to journalist Nicola Tallant, saying that it's true that the unfortunate circumstances of all four individuals' lives probably played a large part in the murder, but that he's also come across violent crimes in his career committed by millionaires and the children of extremely privileged people. So once again, we're brought back to the question of nature versus nurture. That being said, it's impossible to ignore the abusive cycle present in someone like Kathleen's life, and of course in her daughter's. Beyond the scope of the murder, which of course are unusual circumstances, it's not unusual for victims of domestic abuse to enter into more and more abusive relationships. Likewise, the children of those who experience domestic violence are much more likely to suffer abuse later on in their life as well. As far as Farah goes, he was buried at a Dublin cemetery following a service attended by about 40 of his friends. His mother, Samoa Swally Noor, said that she had no money to travel back to Ireland to bid farewell to her son. However, she welcomed the news of the Mulhall sisters' convictions. His wife, who still lives in Kenya, has said that his murder has left their children beyond traumatised and with severe mental health struggles, knowing just how brutal their father's last day was. Despite his flaws and violent past, cannot simply ignore that he was still would have left behind a family who now have to process such a horrific and disturbing murder. As I said at the start of this episode, Farah's past and violent, violent crimes are absolutely disgusting, but no excuse to be murdered by someone else. And you can't ignore how he still would have left behind a family who now have to process this horrific and disturbing murder. That's all we have time for this week on Red Room. If you enjoyed the episode, I'd appreciate it if you'd leave me a 5-star review and follow the podcast on whatever app you're listening to it on. I'll be back next week, where we're discussing a case from outside of Ireland, the murder of a well-known influencer back in 2019. Until then, stay safe. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.